I would like to acknowledge that the Teach Reach podcast is operating on the unceded traditional territories of the Matski, Kwantlen, Catesee, and Semihamu First Nations. Growing up on ancestral territory of the Taino people, and now as an uninvited guest on Turtle Island, I recognize the immense impact that the land has had on me. The land has taught me respect, reciprocity, reverence, humility, and responsibility. Through Indigenous knowledges, I learned that the land carries stories, histories, medicine, and gifts that enable us to reflect and connect with ourselves and our communities. As a stories-focused podcast, I understand the value of investigating place and space to grapple with real-world issues. I seek to support the ways that Indigenous peoples are using to protect their land and communities. It is my intention to continue learning how to properly honor and care for the place where I live. Welcome to Teach Reach Podcast, a podcast to explore human connection through shared stories. Stories are what we store in the vault of our heart. Through them, we are exposed to a variety of voices to understand the narratives that shape our communities. We are all stories, those we know, those we live through, those we fabricate, and those we wish to deconstruct. However, we are not always at the center of those stories. We teach, you reach.
Hey Tungi, tell me about Jamie.
MD of the Boomsday Alliance, also known as Jamie McDonald, is a producer, a hip-hop producer, a film and video game composer, and he's just a phenomenal talent with an amazing mind, a guy that have a vision with sound that is so great. He has his lo-fi line called Chatterless, which I also blast a lot on my earphones when I want to decompress, when I want to relax. And this guy and this conversation that I had with MD was a long time coming. We talked about his producing career, his view of music. And also, throughout the conversation, Jamie was very, very kind and courageous to open a window on his personal mental struggles. And I am deeply appreciative of the moment that I had to discuss, to get to know a little bit more about him, to laugh, and to also reconnect with a great friend. So without further ado, we have here with us MD of the Boomsday Alliance, Jamie McDonald, with us at the Teach Reach podcast. Kembe la palage, enjoy the ride.
Yeah, it's been 10 years I haven't seen Liz. That's, 2012, I think.
Old amount of time.
It's a lot of time not to see a queen. You know, It's like, but maybe that's why. Because she's a queen, you can't see them all the time. See what I mean? Like, you just have to let them be, you know?
I try to tell her every day, yeah.
Yeah. Man, how have you been, brother?
Things have been good. Yeah. Been up and down and wild and crazy, and life's been different, but good. Yeah. Mm. How you been, man?
I've been good, bro. Like, I've been busy. I'm always busy, but I'm trying to not define my life as busy. I've been creating things that I love, connecting with people, growing, losing, and reflecting a lot. that's kind of my life, you know. The last few years, at least, it's been that.
I've always say you're either winning or you're learning. We're doing a lot of learning last
10 years or so. Yeah. It's like, I think there's more learning than winning happening, man.
Yeah.
You know? What are you sipping on now? You're sipping some JD?
No, double Jack on the Rocks, no lime, no straw, of course.
Jeez. I love it. I love it, man. I love it. Yeah. JD, man. Yeah. Yeah, it's been, there's more learning than winning, man. Like, it's been, how would I say that? It's been a lot of questioning too, you know, like finding which path is the best. What do I really want to do in terms of creating poetry, writing, and all that jazz, you know? So it's been a while, a long ride up to be here. Teach Reach podcast, you know.
I wonder how long it's going to be for. She's. I'm sorry about that noise. I got
excited.
I have a new cat, and she is. Hell, apologies to that. I wonder how long it's going to be though in this interview until I inevitably start interviewing you. It just always ends up happening in all my podcast guest appearances. I always
end up. You know, that's a talent. That's a talent you have. That's a talent you have. That I think you know you have it, but it's underrated, the ability that you have to kind of put people in a place where they are the one answering the questions when you are the one that we're interviewing. See what I mean? Like, it's like, I remember when last time I was with you when we were like recording that last poem, my spoken word piece in your in your studio in Gastown, then you came to the booth and you're like, all right, listen something, okay, tell me what position you were in when you were writing this. And I'm like, the hell this guy's talking about, you know, like, I'm supposed to be here, he's supposed to like record stuff, now he's asking me like what position I was in when I recorded that. And then,
I remember that.
And then I was like, what does that have to do? And you're like, okay, let me tell you what. All right, cut the beat. All right, let me tell you something. Okay, the position that you were when you were writing this is the same position that you have to be in when you're performing it. So the same vibe comes in, right?
Exactly. Yeah, your inner monologue needs to match your performative monologue.
And I was like, I think I was mature at that time, but I was not mature to receive that wisdom. So I was like, that's some woo-woo stuff, man. Like, this, I trust MD, but that's some woo-woo stuff, brother.
Your instinct wasn't wrong too, because 99% of production is just like, let's try it out. Let's see what happens. It turned out great. I think those pieces turned out great. I love them,
brother. That was a magical recording. That was a magical moment.
Beautiful stuff.
And I think what instinct do you tap in to produce those magical moments? Because I lived it, but I would like for you, what do you tap into, like, you know, bring those magical moments forward?
Oh, in the moment themselves?
Yeah.
Oftentimes what I'm doing is I'm trying to tell the story 5 years from now. By that I mean, like, I want, this is funny because this actually did happen probably about like what, six, seven years ago or something like
right,
that.
Right.
What I try to do is I try to tell the story down the line a little bit. So in my head, I'm like, how does this sound right now? Well, how do I want the story to sound like down the line? So I'm like, do I want it to be like, and then the session ended horribly and we didn't have a good product or something like that. So it's like in my heart, that's where the point of focus comes from. And then the rest of it comes from, I stand on the shoulders of giants. There's many, many great teachers I've had in the industry. And, you know, I've learned tools and tricks of the trade over the years. And one of them is, putting yourself in the artist's position, because I am an artist myself. It's not too much of a shift for me. There are producers out there. different capacities of different skill sets that don't necessarily approach art in the same way. They really are like purely focused on production. I'm on both sides of the glass, so to speak. I know what it feels like to have directions given and then also to provide them occasionally. Production's a weird game. It's a weird, very strange thing to be a part of because you're essentially you're a leader and you're also the employee at the exact same time because you're being paid to advise someone on what is wrong. You're almost like a consultant in that sense. So production has always been this like very strange animal that I've wrestled with over the years. But when it comes to moments and like actually, you know, pushing out that kind of essence, I honestly have no idea. Sometimes it just happens when it does, like it does. I'd love to claim it was just, you know, something I thought of the night before or something like that. But no, it's in the moment, I'm just like, what were you doing when we were doing this? Because I'm trying to problem solve. You're trying to throw as many things against the wall as possible. But sometimes it's the first one and you think, what was the mindset you had while you were writing this? Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You know, sometimes it's actually physical positioning too, right? Like, were you sitting down writing this? Yeah, you're probably right. In a calm state. Okay, now I got you standing up in a dark booth and, you know, strange and new for some people. Like,
right?
How are we supposed to translate that? Like, it can be different. Plus, we had there was a language barrier there as well too, where we were recording it in another language that the producer didn't necessarily understand.
Right. But that's the thing. It's like it seems that this little maneuver made you able to like go beyond the language, and it's kind of like you tap into a certain universal part as opposed to just, you know, sticking to what the piece that I was recording was about, right?
Right.
And so how did you become a producer? Because I want to imagine that you were an artist first and then you got into producing. So how did you get there to be a producer?
Oh, wow. How much time you got? Because
oh, brother, we have, that's why podcast exists. We have bandwidth. So we're good, you know?
Well, I come from a family of musicians. My grandfather was, on my dad's side, was a pretty popular local musician and regional musician. It's part of a group called the Jaffrey Melick Trio. And when I was young, like really young, like 5-6 years old, I remember the CBC was coming to town. They're going to come do a documentary on Grandpa or something like that. I don't know, some kind of segment. And I saw it recently, actually. My grandma, my grandfather's wife, passed away last year, and there was a lot of reminiscing and going over old archive stuff, and, you know, actually watched this piece of this documentary, and it was amazing. It was actually really well done. It was just a short piece. It was only like 10 minutes or something like that, but
but
I remember watching it and thinking like, oh yeah, you know, this is kind of the genesis, because I would watch him play. He would play fiddle, he would play guitar, and my dad played drums. Still does. Dad plays piano as well. But for me, it all started with, I had an uncle that wasn't my uncle kind of thing. It's just a friend. Well, not a friend, but he was my second cousin really, but he was just much older. He was like 40 when I was like, you know, 10 or something.
Right.
So,
right.
Or it probably seemed 40, but was probably like 20. he was a very brilliant pianist, and he taught over in Germany, and he would come home at Christmas and be like, hey, do you want to learn a piece of music? And I'd say, okay. And he would teach me like, you know, these really intense pieces, but I would be learning them rote, like purely just by like, put your finger here.
Wow.
No sense of technical, like I had no theory behind it whatsoever, no idea what I was doing other than you do this and then you do this and then you do this, you know. So I would learn the right hand. Hmm. And then he would come home from Easter and he'd be like, do you want to learn the left hand? And I'd be like, oh, yeah. And then I'd do that. And I'd be playing like it's a party trick. And I was like 10, something like that. And then that happened like for a year or so. And then my grandma paid for lessons. And I ended up having the same, because I was in a small town, the same teacher, grade 5 and 6. Was my same teacher, but he also was like one of the local piano teachers. So my teacher. So I had like a pretty good kinship with this guy. I basically had him like for 4 years, if you think about it. In terms of, yeah. So got pretty close to them. His name is Mr. Strant is what I call him. Brian Strant. Really, really brilliant. He taught me all about like chord structure and theory, and he'd ask me, what are you listening to? And I'd tell him, hey, I'm watching a lot of TV Land. I'm watching like Hogan's Heroes and stuff. And he'd be like, oh, let's learn the theme song. I'd be like, okay. And then he'd be like, what about now? I'd be like, it's still TV Land. So I'm learning Hill Street Blues. You know, like all these old school shows. Yeah, like Petticoat Junction. Right. But to him, he's like, I have that sheet music. Of course he does, you know? Yeah. And I was learning all this stuff. And then I went ahead and I challenged some exams and Royal Conservatory and theory. And I ended up getting off track from there because high school,
of dating, course,
all kinds of stuff got in the way.
Of course.
But I was rapping the whole time. Mm. I was really writing and at this point, battle rapping. I was like, I would jump on Greyhounds and... like I would go away for the weekend. I tell my mom, I was like, oh yeah, I have friends in this town or whatever. And I did kind of, but they were just like on MSN, like Messenger.
Right.
Kind of. I didn't really know people. But I would show up with like a bottle of Jack in my backpack and just be like, hey, what's up? I'm Jamie. You want to rap?
That's some 8 Mile shit right there.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And then 8 Mile came out, and I was like, oh wow, this doesn't sound so crazy anymore, you know?
Right, right.
So I actually had a bit of experience under my belt, and I remember one time I was like, I was probably only 16, and I was getting snuck into the bars, and there are people that would rap or would come in from, because I'm from a small town in northwestern Ontario called Kenora, in Canada. And there would be, you know, people that come down from the lake in Winnipeg would come out for tourists and stuff. And of course, the big city kids all think they can rap. So they'd sneak me in the bar and be like, hey, this guy over here says he raps, you know, and then they'd take us out to the parking lot and we'd get down, you know, like just, it was funny. And, you know, I did that a few times, but I remember being like 16, being tall enough to be snuck into the bar and people didn't even look inside. I mean, and that happened quite a bit. And then I sold some mixtapes. You know, I rap under and rap and produce under the name MD.
Right.
That was Mickey D for a little while, but then that didn't stay too long. I was MD, and then sold some mixtapes and got a pamphlet one day to go out west to get a recording engineering school. And I remember being in class the first day, and our teacher said, "Who in here wants to be a producer at the end of their course? Like who wants this to be their final gate, you know, their road?" And everyone in the class put up their hand but me. And teacher held me back after class and was like, hey, what gives, you know, like what do you want to do? And I was like, yeah, I just want to be here and learn how to produce so I know how to be a better artist in studio, because right now I don't know exactly what I'm doing. And you know, I think I do, but I know I'm like pretty small town and I'm trying my best here. And it's funny, after all these years, I'm probably the only active producer out of that entire class. Everyone else is now, like, you know, doing other jobs and things like that. But, like, yeah, I still produce, and it's funny how things turn out that way. But yeah,
right.
Got a few contracts after that and just kind of never looked back.
That's beautiful, man. What a story. It's beautiful because it shows how a student of the game you are. Like, you were willing to, you know, learn by experience, take some risks, you know, like, board of Greyhound to go battle with, like, you know, people that you don't know. It's dangerous. It's not borderline dangerous. It's dangerous. Like, I mean, I'm hearing that and I'm like, man, would I let my 14-year-old, 15-year-old get on a bus? But at the same time, it gives you an edge right now in that state of your career where you know, like, you explored the edges and the limits that of your game, right?
Oh yeah. And then that became like a very constant theme within what I was doing. The idea that, like you just mentioned, like, would I let a child at like 14 get on a bus? Like, in my heart, as I'm an uncle of like 17 nibblings, and I would say absolutely not. There's no way I would allow that to happen. But then at the time I was like, nah, I got this. I'm fine. Everything's okay. But
that's right. That's right.
I think it matches certain personality quirks I found out about myself later in life, in mental health. There's certain things about myself I learned in the last few years that I had no idea were affecting me in those decisions. Like those things that seem, wow, those are risks. It's like, yeah, I was taking risks because of mental health issues that I was probably not addressing at the time because I was not aware of
it. Right. And at the same time, it's like, I feel that maybe right now with maturation and knowledge of yourself, you embrace those and you know exactly how to gauge those risks, right? Like, you can gauge them a little bit. It's a battle for sure.
I like to think so. I really like to think so. It's definitely a battle. It's this constant idea of, am I doing this because of who I am inherently, or am I doing this because of what my mental health status is at the moment? You know, like, it's a real trip sometimes, to be honest with you. I have reservations about it. You know, I'll just be straight up about this. Look, I was diagnosed bipolar type 2. 4 years ago, right at the beginning of the pandemic there. Or right just before the pandemic, I should say, just before, at the tail end of 2019. And to anyone who knows me, they just go, oh yeah, that makes total sense. But there's a lot of stigma around bipolar that people don't necessarily understand. It's not erratic moods. In the sense of like up and down in one moment or a day or something like that. That's kind of a misnomer surrounding the actual diagnosis. But it's more of a, especially type 2 myself, it's more of a cyclical emotional state. So it's more of a, you know, up for, when I was younger, it was like up for, and I mean up, like really exhilarating, high, feeling good, up for like, you know, 6 weeks, something like that. And then I'd crash for like 2 weeks. And that was just normal for me. So if I was, hey, I'm jumping on a Greyhound and I'm going to do this and I have all these ideas, I'm going to do this and I have this, this all seemed normal to me at the time. But then like in retrospect, it's like, oh, you were probably experiencing like form of hypomania. There's probably some level of like effect being taken place there where you weren't really aware of it. So yeah, I've been coming to terms with that. And, you know, in therapy, learning things about like not repainting the past. So when you think about these moments, like we're talking right now, Tangy, like we have,
right,
like, oh, like this is the history. This is how did you become a producer? And it's like, okay, right, bringing it up.
Right.
being frank with myself is so easy now because I can think about like, yeah, you know what? I was probably manic at this point.
Right.
Because a lot of that is risky behavior. You don't sneak into bars and travel around randomly with no place to sleep.
Right.
Like that's very strange behavior, but you know, when it works out and it turns out fine. Sure. And that's a lot of the case for creatives with bipolar. You tend to have these really brilliant, you know, coming together moments because you are taking these risks. You are doing that other people aren't doing. Since I've been in treatment, it's been like having Superman's cape ripped off him. It's now I've been relearning how to live for like 4 years. It's been really hard. You know, I'm not gonna sugarcoat it. It's been really difficult sometimes to think about like there. I would not sleep for days sometimes working in studio and producing and being extremely creative and having good output of, you know, my peers would say like, oh, what's happening? What's with this project? Is it done yet? I'm like, not only is it done, I'm on to the next one and I have this next thing going on. And they'd be like, whoa, slow down. What's happening? And right. I felt like, oh, this is totally normal. When I realize now, I'm like, okay, this was like probably a little aggressive for what was happening.
Right. Well, brother, I sincerely appreciate you sharing this here. I don't like when people mention things that are deep within themselves and they are labeled courageous and whatnot because only you know on a daily basis what it means to be courageous for you. But I have sincere gratitude for you sharing up and opening up this on the platform here. And I'm with you on your battle. I'm with you as a brother and I see you. I see you a lot. I see you dearly.
I appreciate that, brother. And you know what, man? It's I've alluded to this before on other podcasts and whatnot, but I've never really dived into it like that before. It's never really been, you know, I figured like if there's one place there would be an open ear for it, it would be here on Teach Reach. Like I think, you know, academia being the hallmark of like some of the podcasts I've been on are like coming up next we have ourselves comedy joke joke like this might not be the place to dive into your mental health, you know.
Right. But go ahead. Yeah.
No, please.
Yeah, and I feel, you know, for me it's something that the mental health conversation, I am glad that more and more right now it's becoming, I don't want to say mainstream, but a little bit more aware, even though it's probably I live in an echo chamber, so I just listen to people that tell me what I know and stuff like that, and people that are on their mental health journey way more deeper and longer than myself know that there are places where there's still stigma, heavy stigma about just the mere mention of mental health being something that purely exists to begin with, right? so for me, it's like I always want to have a space where people are comfortable to be who they are, because there's probably someone somewhere that doesn't have that chance. And that can be feel seen. And even though every time I say feel seen, I feel like I'm short selling, because it's like, it's the basic fucking minimum, right? It's like, there's no way we should like fucking celebrate being seen, because we shouldn't even have to talk about that. We should have to already have that embedded into the way we interact with other people, to see them, to give them space to express who they are, their wins and their challenges, mm-hmm. because it's they take from their challenges to build those wins, right? Like, so there's something that you mentioned while sharing with us that you said there's a moment that you've been working on a project and you haven't slept for days, and you have a track that's called I Haven't Slept for Days. Right? It's like so it's interesting how us humans and creatives and people like you, artists and producers, bridge our experiences into it. It bleeds into what we do, right? There's no way that we can like separate them. So I wanted to say thank you for sharing that, brother.
Oh yeah, of course. And if anyone's out there is listening wants to check out that song, I have to say I Haven't Slept in Days, it's like one of it represents a frenetic time in life when if you listen to it, you'll just understand right away. You're like, oh, this sounds like You Haven't Slept in Days. Like it's
oh yeah,
quite that. And a lot of the stuff I write under the project that this is released under is called Chatterless. A lot of the stuff that I release is Chatterless. Sometimes people will ask me like, oh, is this about you and this? It's like, no, a lot of it's not autobiographical, it's really creative liberties with it, but some of it is, some of it actually is. And like, that's right. Definitely one of them. Yeah, for sure.
Right. Right. So I've been following you since we worked together, and you were at that time, you were more rapper than producer, or like there was a little bit of 50-50 here, and I'll get to that Chatterless portion, because the Chatterless arc or the Chatterless chapter of your producing and your music and your career is more lo-fi, and this podcast is just lo-fi. I listen to lo-fi like freaking 95% of the time. I can't listen to music anymore. I can't listen to people talk.
Yeah,
it's like, I can't listen to people. I can't listen to certain lyrics anymore, because I'm like, I get pissed off about either the way that they constructed, the way that they deliver the bar, and it's just like I'm so like on edge, and I'm like, I'm listening to music to relax, so I'm just gonna listen to lo-fi. But when I met you, you were under the label MD, right? And you produced for me the greatest mixtape of Western Canada of all time. That's me, Fight Club. Wow.
Project Mayhem. Yeah,
Project Mayhem, baby. So tell me a little bit tell the audience a little bit about like that arc on your journey where you're like rapping and you're like involved in the hip hop scene and you are here in Vancouver at that time. So how was that project for you?
Well, what's funny is that project comes up every once in a while in my life, because for different reasons, but mostly it's because of like how we marketed it. The project. So if anyone's not familiar with it, it's a complete rescoring of the film itself and the dialogue, and then restructured with my own original production. So we have dialogue from the film spliced in with the original production, but the dialogue I chose was dialogue without a musical score behind it. So I rescored that music. So there's kind of an element of like, if you love Fight Club already, this here's something for you. You might really enjoy this. It's something different. Right. Shout out to Jay Miz, my collaborator on this project. This was like something we did from the heart. It was really beautiful. But people tend to remember the marketing for this, which was we went and found a soap dispenser, like an actual creator. Yeah. That journey in itself was its own little story, but they were really, really hesitant to get into bed with us on this, because they were like, 20th Century Fox, probably pretty litigious. They're not going to take kindly to this. And we're like, look, it's just for promotional use only. No one's selling anything. We're giving it away. We'll pay you for the soap. There's no worries. But we had them make soap with a Fight Club stamp on it. If you've ever seen the cover of Fight Club, boom, it's like the Fight Club logo stamped into the soap. And then at the time, now this was like 2009, 2010, around that time, if I recall correctly. Around that time, this is when download codes were still just becoming a thing, where you could download codes for music. This is like before Spotify and everything. Right. So we would have download codes elasticed to the soap, and then do our shows and walk around town and hand out soap. So there are people that like would hit us up all the time and be like, hey, I got Fight Club soap on my shelf. Oh my God. Shout out. Have you heard this new song? And Take It Up a Notch. That was one of the songs. All kinds of playback on that song. That's a big one. But yeah, that was how that project came together. It was all done at a house site. I talk about taking risks. Here's another one. I found myself in a situation where I could take on a lease for 5 bedrooms. And I thought to myself, if I take on this lease, I can at least move out artists I want to work with into these rooms and have every single room be like basically a different project going on and different things. I had my brother move out at one point. Two of my brothers, not all three, but two of my brothers moved out at one point. Miz lived out there. There's a bunch of people that live there, but like we would have, if you've ever watched Fight Club, it was like the house was a living, breathing thing. Like that's what it was. the infamous Rupert house. And we kind of created the project out of that. Like everything, even down to like the promotional material, we all shaved our heads, space monkeys, you know. We went out into space. It was funny.
Yeah. That was like, seriously, if even in my family, we quote Take It Up a Notch maybe once a week.
Disrespectful and unprepared. Every fight of my life's a main event affair.
Take it up a notch
so I can shut them down.
Take it up a notch
so I can shut them down.
Take it up a notch
so I can shut them down.
Man, this ain't a circus, we ain't focus on clowns.
Take it up a notch
so I can shut them down.
Take it up a notch
so I can shut them down.
Take it up a notch
so I can shut them down.
Man, this ain't a circus, we ain't focus on clowns.
Every single night we out there having Flight Club. Not surprising that they wanna be just like us.
Like, we would be, no, seriously, we would be at the table and it would be like, Dynamite? Dynamite? And it was just like, you just quote the movie the entire time, like, at least once a week. Like, that's, I kid so you good. Not, still this day. So it's been like 12 years that we've been like, it seemed like a special code. And we might be like in any mood. And then someone mentioned that, and Jose, Maria, and myself, we would just like, laugh our heads off, or just like
Dynamo.
or Jose will just like go on like Mises bars, and I will be like, Jesus, I have to listen to this. And the sick, you have it's interesting because you have in your beats that you produce, there's a cyclical nature that happens, like in terms of like either the synth is like going the same, it's not the same pattern, but it's kind of like the same range that you go in there. Is it on purpose? Is it calculated, or is it pure inspiration? How does that work?
I mean, that project was its own animal of itself. Like straight up, that one, a lot of the times I was like just trying to make everything fit. Like there was a lot of like, I wouldn't say debate, that's too hard of a word, but like there was a lot of conversation surrounding, you know, how much dialogue to include and how much like how long the song should be, etc. Like there was a song on there called Press Release that's popular off that album, and that mixtape is, you know, 10 songs deep, and that's including an intro and an outro. So, you know, out of the 8 songs on it, there's kind of this like rhythm that kind of weaves itself in and out.
None of what you hear and half of what you see, I can smell their fear and they feel what I mean. Get a taste of death, use your sense properly. Just cause they give you news doesn't mean it's honesty.
Look at all the things they teach us. Read down, leak out, and delete us. West to east, make a press release us. They all wanna find where paper street is.
We aggressive, you know this, our essence is gold. And the best say we're next, but I reckon we're chosen.
As a producer, you had got into, you know, producing for video games and documentaries. And how do you get into that? Like, do you get recruited? Do you submit things? How does that world works as a producer, man? Because I don't know.
I wish I knew the answer to this. I wish I don't mean to cut you off, but yeah, I really wish I knew the answer to this, because I could kind of use the answer now. This is like the reality of the situation post-pandemic is a lot of those opportunities are not there the way they were. And now with a writer's strike in place as the time of this recording, you know, it's going to be even longer of a drought until things get going again. Because everything in music is post-production. So we're talking about even if Tangi, the director, films something right now, at best, I'm working on it next spring, you know.
Right.
Or next summer or something like that. It being summer right now at the time of this recording. So at best, and that would be like an independent or something like that. I think the best way I've gotten involved in anything is just having the guts to say hello, just being able to walk up and say hello to someone. I worked on a documentary called Dosed, that came out in 2019, and it was really popular, won a lot of awards. I think it debuted on pretty much every continent that's not Antarctica. And is Antarctica a continent? I'm pretty sure it is, right?
I'm sure it is. I don't know. My geography is lacking, so you got me on a bad angle here.
I always forget what you teach. I'm like, oh yeah, okay, we'll see. But yeah, it was everywhere for a while, and it was playing in festivals and getting all kinds of laurels at the beginning. And I got that because I was working on my podcast and I showed up early one day. That's literally how that happened. I just showed up half an hour early, and I never showed up early. I was always like right on time. Like I was pretty, after like 175 episodes, you just get like pretty in the groove. You know how it goes.
Right.
Although I do envy this virtual way of doing it. Oh my God. Having to always do it in person was something else, but
so hard. Right.
But I showed up half an hour early one day, and these two guys were standing in like the lounge area of like, you know, we did it at Float House in Vancouver, which is a beautiful location, beautiful. And they're in the waiting area, and they had all these cameras and setups. And I was like, oh, what's going on? Just like casually. And the two guys were like, hey, we're filming a documentary. Our subject is in one of the tanks right now. We're just waiting for her to come out. When she comes out, we're going to interview her and get her thoughts on it. And I was like, oh, cool. And I was like, yeah, I do film scores too, if you ever want to chat. And they just kind of gave me the, oh yeah, okay, cool. Like happens every single conversation. Of course. Yeah. And then like 3 months later, I got a call randomly out of nowhere. And it was like, hey, do you want to meet up and just chat about this? And we did. And after that, I ended up scoring the whole film in front of them, actually, which is very rare. Wow. That never happens. But yeah, they were really particular about how they wanted the documentary to sound. And it was really cool. It was a beautiful moment. It's very intense, I'll say that. I don't know if I'd ever do it like that again. But it was a beautiful time, yeah.
Right. What is the greatest quality that a producer should have, in your opinion?
The ability to navigate difficult conversations.
What do you mean?
Yeah, like I think that's all being a producer is having a series of difficult conversations. But, you know, I would often joke about that. I'd say that to everyone, be like, my life is just a series of difficult conversations. It's just something like when someone has a creative vision for something, and like we mentioned earlier, your job is to tell them whether that's like going to work or not. It's like, you don't want to stand in the way of someone creatively, but then if they're trying to do something where keys don't match or tonally or something like that, you have to be able to say like, hey, despite your accolades and fan base and everything else that, and the check you're writing me on this, this doesn't work. You have to be able to say that. It's the person who rolls over and just says, oh, okay, it's fine. That's how bad records get made. And there's a ton of them out there. And you know that, you know it, I know it. There's all kinds of examples we can point to. But I think that would be the most important thing, being able to navigate a difficult conversation. And I don't mean that by being a jerk or something like that. I mean, just right. Having the empathy to see someone from the other side and just be able to have a normal conversation. Like if you're in a functioning relationship romantically, you should be able to do this in a production sense, is what I'm saying. It's the people that are like, I can't stand it. And like, they lose their mind. Travel. They're going to have a hard time. They're going to have a difficult time doing this job.
Right. Oh man, that's beautiful. I love that. Having a series of difficult conversation. It's true. Now, how do we arm ourselves to have those difficult conversations? Like, you know, is there, do you just say, you know what, I'm just gonna say what I think and whatever happens, happens? Like, how do we prep ourselves or arm ourselves in order to, you know, get in that and have that difficult conversation?
That's a good question. First thing I do typically is I let the situation exhaust itself first. Like you don't want there to be more vitriol towards you for bringing up the problem than the problem itself. So letting someone like just punch themselves out is kind of like, if there's something that's not working creatively, let it burn out. And until if they're frustrated with it and they're like, why isn't this working? What's going on? It's like, okay, let's have a conversation. Let's talk about it. It's like, I think it's not working because blank. Now, what we can do is blank and blank, but you might be better served if we just let go of blank. Like that would be one way of approaching it. Another way would be having the person, this is more tricky, but having them tell you why it's not working. This one I don't recommend as much because it can go sideways. But yeah, you're like, if you just like, yeah, I don't know what's going on here. And they're like, maybe it's this. You're like, maybe it is.
Right. That's right. So that I can see how the second one would be like very difficult because maybe the person is unable to articulate how it doesn't work. And there's a lot of, I feel the more I listen to you as a producer right now, and I'm gonna take a shot at my own producer Ian, the more I listen to you guys is the more that I see that your job is more like a counseling job in a strange way, right?
100%. You just nailed it. 100%. Oftentimes what I'll say in session is this job is 85% psychology. It's 15% knowledge of like gear and whatnot, but like even that's not anything to me. It's the ear, it's not the gear, it's what you're able to do with it. It's not what you're using, you know. It's the psychology behind it. If someone comes to session and they're throw down their bag and their jacket, they whip it off and it's raining outside and they're upset, the session's already in like a low point. It's up to you to, hey, what's going on, let's check, what's going on, figure it out,
right?
We don't even see a microphone until it's good. Like, and by that, I mean like pre-production is everything. Sometimes I'll pre-produce with an artist like 3-4 sessions in a row before we even touch the booth, you know, like we want to have such a good relationship that I want, when I open the door to the studio, I want it to be, okay, we're ready to work. This is a good time. Everyone's about to have a good time. Cool. I don't want it to be like stressed, nervous. You let me down, I let you down. That's not the tone we're setting. We're setting a relaxed vibe. You know, that's what I want. I've never had a meltdown in studio. I've never had an art. I've heard horror stories of people like where, you know, things get thrown and things like that. Like I've never had anything even close to that. Not even close.
Wow. Yeah. Well, yes, I remember when I recorded with you the first time, that was on Mizzy's album, Commiserate Your Soul.
Oh yeah.
First time that we recorded, you had like, before I was like, this guy is crazy. Before every take, you would have a joke. And then it's just like would make me laugh and I would feel so relaxed. But now I know that it's intentional. Like it's kind of like, you know, it's part of the job. Like you want to take and no, and what I appreciated as well is that there was no judgment. At least I didn't feel there was a judgment if the take didn't go well. And then you're like, let's go back again. And then you punch another joke in there and then we go back to business. It was right. Like, yeah.
Oh, it's like one joke I'd say all the time is, oh yeah, we're running out of tape. So, I hope you know that we only got two takes left, you know, it's like, like we just start and it's like,
yeah, it was, it's just interesting to see that everything that goes into, you know, getting the artist into the booth. Now, maybe that's my last question as a producer side of things, because I want to get to your chatterless chapter here. But as a producer, and we've established that, you know, you're providing counsel, you making sure that the artist and the creative is comfortable and everything. But what about you, the producer? Where is your anchor? What is the thing that helps you come into that space ready to be ready for the artist?
Man. Sometimes it's literally just yourself. You know, at the end of the day, you're just kind of alone with it. Like 5 inches from the mirror and telling yourself everything that has to be done that day. You know, it can be pretty tough. It can make you feel like you're alone with it sometimes. But the anchor, I would say, you know, you got to rely on the people around you. Like, if you're in a really, like, a very unique situation, if you're a collaborator at the time, someone you're working with, like, I really got to give it up to, like, you know, guys that I've worked with over the years, like Maka, like yourself, like Mizzy, these guys, like, you know, I've worked with a lot of really talented dudes over the years, and ladies as well, obviously, but like, I'm just mentioning just offhand here, but
of course,
I have to bring up, like, there's something special sometimes when you collaborate with some people and they actually give that back to you. So that's, you don't necessarily feel like you're in it alone and you're responsible for everything. That's what it comes down to. Cause if the record does well, then typically the artist is admired for it and that's great. And that's cool. And if you peel back the layer, then yes, sure. The production gets its appeal and that's cool. That's awesome. But like, if things go bad, they go, who produced that record? Who did that? Who was involved in that? And so you're responsible for a lot of it. And that's kind of where I talk about being alone with it and like having to see maybe a little bit beyond the initial pressure of it.
Yeah, that's true. It's I sometimes have that analogy about parenting. And it's the same in sports as well, right? If the team goes well, the players are fantastic. If the team starts losing, it's the coach's fault. Same thing in parenting, right? If your kids are amazing, if your kids are doing great, oh, they are fantastic people. They are self-made. And then if they are, you know, not even remotely good, I don't know by what metrics, but whatever, it's you, the parent. You're a bad parent, right? So it's you can't win. But I'm glad that you kind of like mentioned that having an opening to receive from the people and also I think as creatives, good talent, good artists understand the challenges that goes beyond. Like they don't see themselves as the focal point; they see the team, right? So so the producer is also part of the team for sure. As we are getting into now your chapter of Chatterless, but I vaguely remember that Chatterless was your podcast, right? Your podcast was called Chatterless, wasn't it?
No.
I'm mistaken.
That's okay. And you know what? If on my podcast, I would feel just like you do right now, where I'd be like, oh no.
I don't know. I don't have a research team, people. I don't have a research team. I'm just doing the whole research by myself. So yeah.
You're a one-man show, they say. No, yeah,
that's
no producer.
Right.
You're fine.
That's okay. Right.
No. So I had a podcast titled Intergalactic Interviews.
Intergalactic Interview. Yes. Yeah. And the background, and it was a blue background, and I confused it with your first Chatterless. I'm trying to justify my mistake here. And that's I'm confusing okay. No, you're doing good. with your first Chatterless release. which is phenomenal. So yes, you had Intergalactic Interviews. That's true. That was the podcast.
Yeah. So Chatterless, Intergalactic Interviews started like, 2012, 2013, I think around there, and ran until 2019. It went through many different iterations of studios and whatnot, but it was a great time. I did it as I think I heard you mention in one of your episodes, I think you did with our mutual friend, Brittany Fair.
Right.
I think you mentioned that you're a natural archivalist.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I'm a natural archivist, if I get a fact wrong, the entire factory in my head right now at this very moment is going like, we messed up. The whole project is collapsed right now, because how can you be trusted anymore? You can't be trusted. You're not a good archivist. Like, it's like I don't know if you've seen that movie Soul.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Right. And then it's like when one of the guys in heaven lost a file. Right. And he's like, it's impossible. We can't lose a file. Like, that never happens. So yes, but yes, I'm a natural archivist, man.
I remember hearing you say that in one of the shows, and I'm the same. I actually am the same. I feel the same way too about facts and stuff too. There's all kinds of stuff over the years and episodes where I've been like, oh my God, whatever. But the main point being here that we share that in common, that we want to archive these things. And that's what Intergalactic Interviews became. Because I looked around the scene of entertainment in Vancouver, and I thought, there's a lot of really cool things happening here, but no one's documenting it. There's no one who's like taking a memory capsule of what's happening.
Right.
A friend of mine once said that Vancouver has an incredibly giant head, but a very tiny body. There's no body supporting the head. So who's the body? And I was like, oh, I'll be the body for a little bit, And now, now you're fantastically doing that too. So thank you for tagging in. Appreciate that. I stopped doing that podcast in 2019 because it would burn like 3 days a week for me, and I was still producing full time. So I was redlining my engine hard. I just couldn't do it anymore. So I started this project called Chatterless, and it's an instrumental project. What happened was I took my MD logo one night around 3 or 4 a.m. another late night, couldn't sleep. And I had all these beats and songs I wrote, and I kept putting the logo on this cover art. And every time I put it on there with the cover art, it just didn't look right. And I couldn't figure out why. And I was like, okay, maybe it's because it's not MD. Maybe it's like, I am MD, but maybe it's not this. Maybe it's something different. So I sat there and it just kind of hit me one day. I'm like, what? Like that same night, I was like, what happened? Like, what did every report card say to me growing up? It was like, Jamie is a good part of our class, but would do well to not speak so much and engage with others. And I thought, oh, okay, so not speaking, chatting, chatterless. Okay, and it's an instrumental project, so there's no speaking. So there's no vocals at all. So it became Chatterless. And I started off with a Christmas album. I thought that would be just, here's a way to creatively flex what I'm doing with other people's music, So it was just me playing piano. And then I released some lo-fi songs. I started with Wake Up Aurora. And then I released you know, I released some synthwave stuff, some summer dresses, and I put out, well, yeah, it's called From Secret Gods and Dead Cities, but, and then I put out Insecurities Melt, and people, yes. I think the one you really enjoy, Insecurities
that,
Melt.
That project, Insecurities Melt, it reached me, it resonated with me so hard, man.
That's beautiful. Thanks, man. I appreciate
it's,
that.
It's just, now, I whenever I tell people that I listen to lo-fi, the first question I have is like, what is lo-fi?
Yeah.
So as a lo-fi artist, what is lo-fi?
I think other lo-fi artists will give you a different answer. But for me, here's my answer. I actually don't produce it the way they do. A lot of them sample, there's like 10 really classic records that they'll sample. That's why a lot of lo-fi sounds the same.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them will sample these records. I don't sample. I play everything. So all my stuff is original. So I have kind of a different tweak on the sound. But lo-fi being mostly that the drums and the overall master is processed at a quality that it almost has more of an analog feel, like almost a faux analog feel. Like, so there's kind of a hiss to the drums. There's more of a distortion to some of the actual melody itself. And then sometimes it actually will actually distort the actual, like it'll actually blend together in the background that maybe shouldn't be blending. Like it's,
right.
It's kind of, lo-fi is very broadly defined in its own genre, but that's what I would say from a dynamic point of view.
The first time I got into lo-fi, the thing that used to frustrate me, and now, like, I don't know, whatever, I'm going to say it. The thing that used to frustrate me as a consumer was the fact that the songs were so short. I'm getting into the groove of the song, and then it's like, cut to another one. And then I'm like, I need to understand this. So I think I wasn't the only one. So I kind of like Googled it late night. I'm like, why is lo-fi so short? And apparently it's because you have to listen to the entire project is a story. So it clashes with the way that we consume music nowadays, where it's like singleton or like, you know, 2-3 tracks, but now it's an entire album, an entire project. And that, when I started to really appreciate that, okay, now I can follow a track. And that's why Insecurities Melt is like, it's put together and you listen to it and you're like, I feel you. Like, it's just like, I feel the person, right? And we were talking about I Haven't Slept in Days, and the first 45 seconds of that song are so charged that you like, if I was that charged physically, there's no way I could sleep.
Yeah, right? That's exactly what I'm saying. I'm so glad to hear this and to speak with someone who like picks up on it. Because like when I wrote it, that's what I'm feeling. So like, it's so nice to hear that. You know, another thing with, the other thing with the duration of song length for lo-fi, not all of them, but some of those artists are gaming the system a little bit. So they'll make a song that's like typically like 2 to 3 minutes. They'll make a song that's like a minute 10, and then it kind of forces you into that, oh, I have to play it again. So then you'll see that their song counts are like, you know, 2 million for that one, but everything else is like 20,000, 10,000.
Kind of. Right.
Yeah. So there is a gamesmanship there, but I know what you mean.
how do you, so that's an interesting thing, because now as an artist and a producer, you have like both perspectives. How do you feel about the world of views and downloads and streaming, and How do you navigate that well? How do you feel in that? Having as well, you produce like, you know, scores for a documentary, for example. How do you live in that world of views, streaming, and downloads and whatnot?
Well, I wrote a song called "You Are Not Your Numbers," and it's kind of a bastardized version of, you know, Fight Club's "You're Not the Contents of Your Wallet," essentially. Like, I feel the same way. You know, everything kind of influences itself in that stage. But "You're Not Your Numbers" for me is like everything about that. It's everything about views and counts and likes and retweets. And it's, if you look at the track listing of Insecurities Melt and you read the song titles, it's supposed to be a roadmap for me when I'm not feeling so good. It might seem really selfish to put out something like that, but it's really for me to remind myself. It's like, hey, be soft with yourself. You know, there's other, like, none of this is real. Like, all these song titles I wrote, they're like, it's supposed to remind myself that I'm part of something that's much bigger than myself. And I when you get focused on views and likes and all this social media stuff, it's like, it makes me feel very tiny. I'll be honest right now. I hate promoting more than anything about entertainment, more than anything, is I hate promoting. I love speaking with you. I love doing podcasts and stuff. Like you mentioned, you know, some of this is like innate, just being able to have nice conversations. That's a beautiful thing. But like when it comes to like, okay, I made a song. Now I have to make 10 pieces of content associated with that song just to get it out there. And then I have to 10x those pieces of content until I have 100 pieces of content. Like, what are we doing here? Am I a social media farm or am I a musician? Am I someone who is like, you know, trying to get hired on as a social media manager somewhere, or am I semi decent at making drums and piano? Like that's
right.
That's what I'm talking about. Like I get very frustrated with the idea that the current model in the media market that we live in is based around who can attract the most attention, because it's not necessarily supporting the best artists, so to speak. It's all subjective, but there are some objective points where you can be like, how come this person doesn't have enough views? How come this person doesn't have share? You know, so that's kind of my thoughts on it.
Yeah. It's we do a podcast and I'm in the same boat as well of the questioning of like, you I'm know, sure. like you have to, and I don't want to say you have to, but you get sucked into that world, right? You get sucked into that trend of like, my content is an hour and a half long. I have to splice it to 15 digestible seconds. And then those 15 digestible seconds, I have to make, you know, this amount of posters for it so it can link to it. And then I want to, and then that's why sometimes it's good to take a step back and to be like, why am I doing this? And myself, I'm doing this because I like connecting with people like you, having good conversation. Yeah. I like connecting with people that most people that I'm inviting is people that I'm interested in. And I'm like, maybe one or two people will be interested in. Right. Yeah. And then that's what will stay in for posterity or whatever. But it's just, for me, it's more about the connection than the, you know, the distant connection that I will have with, you know, someone in Arkansas, you know. So
yeah, it's really, you know, the quality of these conversations, because the reality is like, we haven't seen each other in 5 years. Now, granted, pandemic burned a couple of years there, so sure, we'll take a couple of years off the board. But in reality, because we haven't seen each other, these conversations are beautiful. This is like, this is us catching up. This is us being able to have those kind of, like, when else do we have these opportunities to speak to people long form and have this like great moments? It's a beautiful thing about podcasts. It's, you know, you're right. If you could have a better connection here in the moment with your guest than, you know, the random guy in Arkansas, whoever, that means a lot more overall because you're more enriched for it. But this person in Arkansas might be more enriched just by having like someone to listen to on their ride to work or whatever.
Exactly. Of course. Of course. Oh no, for sure. We don't take for granted the people that are, you know, listening and everything. Big gratitude for that. I'm more myself is sometimes in the mind of someone who create things. There's always the little voice that creeps in to be like, well, yesterday there was zero downloads. You know, it's like yesterday there was zero downloads. What the hell is that thing, right? And then it takes a lot of mental fortitude or sometimes resilience to be like, I'm not going to look at the numbers. And I often do not. I'm just like, my connection is made and the minimal promotion that I will make to kind of like get that podcast out, I do it. And then the rest, if it's meant to be, it's meant to be. Something it will pick up, right? So
You and I are your numbers. Remember that. You know, I think an even better way of putting that is a rule I've made for myself this year, which is one is better than none. One is if you have, because there are days I'm sure for you that it's like much, much more than none. I'm sure it's like much, much, much higher, right? But the days where it's one, it's like, wow. The thing I always tell the artists I work with is, you never know who's listening. You never really know who's listening. And by that, I mean, like, you know, downloads are one metric, of course, but like if it's a song play or a episode play or something like that, it's like, okay, a song play could be in a restaurant playlist for like 300 people.
Right.
You have no idea. And then five people Shazam it. And then, you know, you have no idea. Like it's, you never have any idea how many people are listening. And then they get upset because it's like it's only one play. It's like, yeah, but that one play might be like someone who really, really is going to move your product or, you know, get you around.
That's right. That's right. What a voyage. What a journey. What a enlightening conversation and deep dive into producing, creating, journey as mental health. I've always finished with teach and reach for you to share with the audience one teachable moment for you and one thing that you would like to, you know, how can people reach out if they need producing and everything. So we'll fix the teach reach in terms of like a teachable moment for you and then the reach is where can they reach you at.
When you are in the process of negotiating contracts, I would highly recommend that you, no matter what, you maintain and retain as much publishing as possible. Publishing is your long-term residuals that you get. You know, I get checks quarterly for music that I made years ago that still pays out through TV and commercials in Europe and you know, the States and et cetera. But it would not be possible unless I retained that publishing. Sometimes you have to fight for it, but that would be like, you know, I know that's probably pretty basic to say that. Maybe something more would be like, if you find yourself in a situation where it's too good to be true in music, it really, very likely is. And that would be the teach portion of that. And for the reach, you can hit me up on social media, on Instagram, at MD_Boomsday. I'll chat with you. I likely have a pretty decent chat with you. If you're cool, I'm cool.
That's amazing. We will also put the links to your Spotify account, your Spotify channel, Chatterless. Those are music that I have. I'm very particular when I drive on my way back home from an event. So if I go out, I have music to go out. And if I'm coming back home, I have music to back home. And 100% of the time when I'm going back home, it has to be music with no lyrics, no lyrics at all. So Shadowless is in the rotation, and it's just like you're driving home and you're about to, like, you know, come back to your own cave, right? So it's always good. So I'll put a link in there so people can vibe to it too, man.
Oh, bless you, brother. Appreciate that, man. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Teach Reach podcast. This podcast is produced by Dr. Lemstein Productions, mixing and editing by Ian Lam. If you are enjoying this podcast, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give us a review on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at teachreach_podcast and tag us on your social media post and share with your friends with the hashtag #TeachReachPodcast. For our regular listeners, we truly appreciate your support. Thank you. You can find more about our podcast at teachreach.podbean.com. Until next time, Kembe la palage. Hang in there. Don't give up.